This is Brent Bowmaster, Warhammer Fantasy fanboy.
And I am Jason, the creator of the Army Showcase, and in my hands is Warhammer Fantasy 8th Edition. And that's the sound this giant tome makes when it hits the table. We'll break down the latest edition of Games Workshop's flagship product on this episode of the Tabletop Battlefield. Welcome back to Season 4, Episode 15 of the Tabletop Battlefield, the official podcast of the Army Showcase over at TabletopBattlefield.com. And just a few weeks ago, Games Workshop released the latest edition of Warhammer Fantasy Battles, which of course is one of their two main lines. This is the 8th edition of the game, and it's... I mean, look at this, the rulebook. This thing is huge. Have you had to play this a lot so far, Brent?
I've played about half a dozen full serious games and a whole bunch of little test scenarios and stuff, and I've been reading it so much that I'm starting to dream about it.
Wow, that's kind of believable. There's a lot to read in this book, so let's just start talking about this book itself. It's about it's over 500 pages. I think we're at 510 if you include the index, and it's full color. Now, is this the first time GW has actually produced an entire full-color rulebook from start to finish?
For the standard stuff, yeah. They've done, like, collector's editions that have been full-color.
Okay.
But this is the first full-color rulebook for absolutely everything.
It's definitely a really beautiful rulebook. I'm probably going to start a little bit of fanboy war here, but I still think Privateer Press has a little bit of edge with their War Machine books. But this is by far... at least what I've seen, the prettiest Games Workshop book yet. I love the fact that they have the little figures on all the side and little fancy banner artworks and stuff. It looks really, really nice. How about the price? $75 for this thing. It's definitely the most actually, it's not really the most expensive rulebook. There is the collector's edition that comes, leather-bound. But as for standard rulebooks at Games Workshop, this has been the most expensive series, correct, for Warhammer Fantasy and 40K?
As far as I know, yeah. Definitely a little bit of ouch looking at the $75 on the credit card bill.
Yes. I'll be honest, at least in my opinion, though, once you've actually got to look through and see what's in here, it is worth, I think, $75, because there is so much more than just the rules. You've got lots of fiction, I'm saying. You got a whole miniature showcase of all the pictures. I mean, do you think it's worth $75? I think that's a little too much for you.
Well, I'm a poor fanboy, but I think it's still worth the $75. I've been playing the game for over 20 years now, through four full editions of it, and there's still stuff in the background that I'm learning new. It's brand new stuff that's in this book. It's like I've never seen it before. It's not like it conflicts with something else, but it's new material that they put in, and there's so much in there besides just the background. The miniature showcase isn't even all they show about miniatures. It's like you can hardly turn a page without seeing a picture of a cool miniature.
Yeah. Also, you even have some hobby stuff in here, and it's like, is there like a area that's like historical scenarios per se, where they're kind of, I'm trying to look at some of these things, where like actual like scenarios from the fiction of Warhammer Fantasy, not just like standard tournament kind of things?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Toward the back, there are more scenarios. There's one about a delivery of beer to Bugman's Brewery, delivery from the brewery to an inn, and you get the fight over the delivery cart and the inn.
And that's a dwarf mission, I assume.
Well, it doesn't have to be. I mean, anybody likes a good beer, but there's missions like that. There's last stand missions. These type of scenarios. Those are in addition to the pitched battle scenarios that they put in the beginning of the book in their battle section.
So one thing I was going to say about there's two things. Well, actually, there's kind of two things I've kind of liked about GW rulebooks. One is there's always somewhere in here a very cheesy handshake picture. The two people who run the demo game in it. And this time, I believe it is it Matt and Jervis in this one, in the very front? But definitely, though, in 5th edition, Warhammer 40K, the cheesy handshake picture was so bad. This one's not so bad, but like I said, the one in 40K was just awful. I like how though, you have the handshake picture and then you've got the guys drinking beer at the bar afterwards. It's a nice classy touch they do there. But I just want to say one thing about this book just in general. This is definitely for like the veteran player. I really don't think they're intending this book to be for like a brand new fantasy player, because it's very intimidating to the new players, I have to say.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's like you slap this 529-page full-color hardbound book on the table, shaking all their miniatures down onto the floor, and then you say, "By the way, this is just the basic rule book. You still need to buy your army book." And it's kind of intimidating. But at the same time, it is aimed at a new player because everything about the hobby is in that book.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's probably just considered a bit of a public service announcement. If you got someone coming up to you who's never played Warhammer Fantasy before, have them run through a game or two without before they actually see this book, because I could see someone coming up and seeing this thing as a rule book, not knowing that most of it is, non-core rules, and just getting really intimidated and just kind of walking away. So I definitely don't pull this book out right away when someone, like, wants to play Warhammer Fantasy for the first time, in my opinion, but.
Yeah, I can see that. The intimidation factor's there. When they have to set down everything in their hands and clear a spot on their table just to look at the book, that's a bit of an issue. Hopefully the smaller rule book that comes with the box set that's coming out in October, hopefully that one won't be quite as intimidating.
I don't think it will. I want to say I've actually seen the smaller rule book, at least in the GW stores. They had, the usual pocket-sized rule book, but it had the Warhammer Fantasy 8th edition cover on it. So I think the GW stores already have that in, at least, or somebody. I'm pretty sure I saw one in there, but I don't know, maybe something different. But let's talk Sorry, what were you saying?
I was going to say, I saw a picture of it on their website. Okay. They're breaking up the new box set, so they showed it. It's small, but it's hard to tell how thick it is and how teeny the print might be.
Mm-hmm. Do you know now who's in the box set for the starter set? It's High Elves and Skaven, right?
High Elves and Skaven, yep. It's the Island of Blood is the name of the box set.
And are there any details about how many figures are in there, or is it just very generic stuff at this point?
They have it all broken out. I think they said there's 78 total figures in there. High Elves, there's a lord riding a griffin. A whole bunch of Sea Guard, Swordmasters, Aurelian Reapers, and Skaven, they're just a bunch of rats. I don't know what all they have.
This is all on GW's website then?
Yep.
Awesome. Well, I'll bring it up here in a moment. But also, have you got any of the other accessories, like the deck of cards or the various, new rule books, new measurings and tokens and things? Or did you just get the actual rule book?
Well, between my brother and I, we managed to gather up everything that they own.
Okay.
That allowed us to buy. The only things that are really necessary, of course, are the rule book and some type of measuring. The new templates, though, they look very cool. The counter, most counters usually aren't that big a deal, and they're just kind of silly, but this one actually has some utility to it, so I kind of like it. The new measuring devices, one's just a big fancy fold-up ruler.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, is the old-style chart navigation kind of tool, and that actually has more utility than I ever thought. I never really realized how many things I knock over with a standard tape measure that are much safer using that new measuring tool.
So the new measuring tool is like an artist's compass, right? Basically, you spread it out by an angle, and you can measure distance between two points like very precisely, correct?
Yep, exactly. Just like old-style navigation chart dividers.
That's pretty cool, because you have the one point like right at the edge of the base of the unit and the other point at the other edge, and you get an exact measurement where, like you said, it'd be tough to do with a normal tape measure.
Yep, it's proven its utility already in the half dozen games that I've played so far.
Very cool. How's the quality of those things? Are they pretty sturdy or they seem kind of flimsy? Because I know like the templates, they're kind of just, they look, from the pictures, look just kind of like rings of plastic with little fancy decorations on them.
Yep, they look pretty fragile, but they're not.
Okay.
They're fairly thick, not quite a quarter inch thick. I'm going to say like 3/16 or something. And it's, you know, good solid plastic. It's not brittle,
okay,
like the clear plastics can be. You know, it's slightly flexible. I've already sat on mine, and they haven't broken yet. So everything seems to be pretty good. You know, I don't know how the measuring tool is going to hold up over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of friction, you know, moving it in and out. It's like 2 inches, 4 inches, 8 inches, 12 inches back and forth. You know, eventually it may wear down. But they're not flimsy. You know, if you take reasonable care of them, like say half as much care as you take of your models, they're going to last. They're good solid pieces.
Okay, that's cool. Well, let's move on to actually talk about the gameplay, finally. For setting up the game, some of the big changes have been, one, how you build your armies. Like in previous, at least I don't know, all previous editions, but say 7th edition, you would have, you know, so many slots for each type of unit. So, you know, you take a minimum of 2 core choices. You could have a lord in like 2,000 or above points. You could have at most, say, 3 characters. Now, obviously, in 8th edition, you got a situation where it's percentage-based. So, for example, you know, 25% of your army has to be core. Or then it's like, I think it's up to 50% special, up to 25% for rare. I think, and then there's also additional percentages for both heroes and lords. How do you think that's going to affect the gameplay? Do you like it or do you not like it?
At first, I was a little worried about it because I played during 4th and 5th edition when that was the standard way to put together your army, all percentage-based.
Okay.
And I really liked what happened in 6th edition when they went to the different slots.
So this is actually going back then to previous editions in Warhammer Fantasy.
Yep, it's bringing that back. It's
okay.
Not entirely a reissue of that, though, because back in 4th and 5th edition, you had your lords and heroes, your characters, and you had your troops, and you had war machines, and those were pretty much the only categories. You didn't have core, you didn't have special, you didn't have rare.
Okay.
And the heroes really weren't split out.
So you said you kind of had a little bit concerned about it, but has it turned out you like it pretty good now or not?
When you take a look at the entire game and how it plays, the elements of 4th and 5th edition that people didn't like that were tied to the percentage system are minimized or even eliminated.
Okay.
It would be a really good thing. For me personally, I have a lot of troops that never see the table, not because they're not good enough, but just because I run out of slots and I have to take my handful of favorites all the time. And now I can bring them out. Now they get a chance to see the table. They get a chance to do their fun little quirky things.
Yeah, I think that's probably the big advantage of the system. I know, like, some people are talking about when they saw the idea that, you know, heroes were so many percentage and things, and our people might start running like hero spam armies, but the reality is, under the old system, like you're saying, you would take your 2 or 3 best units and kind of those not so cool heroes. Like I know for the Lizardmen, we have like the Skink Chief, and some of the, you know, the kind of non-name heroes never got played. Do you find yourself using more stuff like that then?
Absolutely. I play Orcs and Goblins primarily, as well as High Elves, and with the Orcs and Goblins. Goblin characters, the only, you know, nobody ever fielded them competitively. They're good.
Mm-hmm.
You're not gonna give up a slot for a character to a goblin when you can put, you know, some dead hard orc in there that's
okay.
Got twice
yeah.
The toughness, you know, half again the strength and the ability to scream and everybody smaller in addition. But now it's like, you know, okay, I've got that orc. And I can take a couple little goblin guys just to beef up the goblin units because it's just a matter of points now. It's not a matter of slots. And they don't take very many points.
Yep, so I think it's going to definitely see some more diverse armies over time. Hopefully, anyway. I guess we'll probably check back in a year and see how the game shaped out. But let's keep on some of the more just kind of setting up the game stuff. One of the other big changes comes in the form of terrain. And two things is, one, there's a lot more terrain in the table, at least definitely possible, it's possible to have a lot more terrain in the table in this edition than previous editions. And the terrain is a lot more crazy and off the wall. So what do you think about this stuff?
I personally am very much in favor of that. I never really liked the fact that most of my army seemed to be fighting over the 14th fairway. It's a change, and it makes things a little more tactical.
Mm-hmm.
You have to worry about your battlefield, not when you're building your list so much, but turn by turn, especially with some of the terrain being variable in the middle of the game. It's like a forest. You don't know what kind of forest that is until you actually set foot in it.
Mm-hmm.
It might be benign. It might be beneficial to you. It might be really hostile. Forests and rivers and even some buildings are like that. You're not sure what's going on with them. Other things, they have variable effects that go on. Like there's a sinister statue, and it's got a 50% chance of zapping somebody every turn if they're close by. You have to wonder, it's like, am I going to risk a couple units by there? That makes the game more tactical, because before, you were, pretty much everybody just said, okay, there's the woods that I have to go around, there's the hill that I stick my war machines on, and maybe if they were in a really good mood, they put a building on there, which is another thing that most people moved around. Seventh edition had detailed rules for, occupying buildings and how to assault them, and nobody really ever used them. They were extremely rare to actually be in use. Now, the rules are much more flavorful, and you almost can't avoid them, because they say on an average board you should have at least seven pieces of terrain. They're saying die six plus four.
Yeah.
Where in the older editions you might end up, if you were lucky, especially in competitive tournament type games, with three or four total pieces, and they're probably going to be, small hills and little forests, and they're going to get shoved in the corners and stuff too. The whole terrain section, not only does it give you rules for the competitive type environment, but it really encourages you to shift stuff around to help fill a narrative. You've got a little settlement over here and a watchtower. Why stick them in opposite corners? Maybe that watchtower is watching over the settlement. Maybe that swamp is the reason why that statue is guarding it. That used to be some waystone that, kept some ancient spirit in the swamp. All those type of things are put into the new terrain rules. And not only do they help the story, but they help the battle to become more varied, more tactical, less battle number 714.
So it's pretty much safe to say, remember last year back on our 40K vs. Fantasy episode, the Warhammer 40K fanboy, Jerry, basically accused Fantasy of being an empty board with two lines of troops marching towards each other. Those days are definitely long over then.
Absolutely. 8th edition, if you pay any attention to the rules that are in there, and not just scrap them out for your own rules, even the standard pitched battle that everybody has played most of their games in for 6th and 7th edition,
mm-hmm.
that is now varied. They've called in 6 balanced scenarios, including different deployment. There's no longer that's your side of the board, this is my side of the board, everybody sets up within 12 inches, just like we've done for the last 2 decades. Now you can set up diagonally across the board, apocalypse style, like the 40K apocalypse games. There's some end-to-end battles, which are very interesting. King of the Hill type battles, where you have a defender in the middle. And these are just the pitch battle scenarios. The scenarios toward the back of the book, where they have more narrative scenarios, they actually have a setup where they have a last stand where you put the defender's army is one-third the size of the attacker's army, and it's not a matter of who's going to win, but as in how long the defender will last.
Mm-hmm.
That's what determines the wins.
That's kind of cool. Let's go back to the terrain for just a minute. I know in a 1,000-point game I played, we did the whole, the D6 plus 4 pieces of terrain and managed to roll a 6, so we had 10 pieces of terrain out there. And it seemed a little bit claustrophobic. Do you think there's any concern about, that in large-scale games where you're actually going to have situations where units just can't move through an area and it kind of blocks off huge portions of the board, or you don't think so?
I think so. I think it'll happen. And I think it's actually a good thing. Some of the new rules, which we'll get into in a little bit, encourage bigger blocks of troops.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, if your terrain gets really cluttered, those bigger blocks might not be as useful as you want them to be. And some of the cheaper, smaller, more mobile units, they'll get to shine. And that encourages people to build a more balanced list. The one-trick pony list where you come out with, you know, this is the way my list works and it's going to do things, terrain can screw that up tremendously. And a lot of people, of course, are going to complain about that. But at the same time, if you know, if people rise to the challenge and say, you know, hey, I can't count on the terrain being anything similar from game to game, I'm going to build my list to work with it and learn how to play my army around different terrain, you're going to see more varied games, you're going to see more tactical situations, you're going to see more fun, at least in my opinion.
So it's safe to say, when you're building an army now, you can't count on the terrain. So you really got to make a more general list that can factor in a whole bunch of different situations.
Right, absolutely. Before, the only thing you really worried about with terrain was, am I going to have a hill to help deploy my war machines on so they can see over everybody? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, am I going to have a forest in the way? Or maybe you had a special unit like, you know, with the wood elves that uses forests. But other than that, terrain was just pretty much a couple things that you moved around and not a big deciding factor in the battle.
Okay.
Now, it's even possible that the battle could be decided by the way you use the terrain. In fact, with some of the variable terrain being, you know, hostile, it, although it's a long shot, it's possible that both sides could lose and have nothing left on the board because the terrain's killed it all.
Possible. I've had a little bit of that when I walked into the little forest that whip your guys around, whatever those, the magical, or what are they, the mysterious forest, yeah. And one of them is like the giant trees that come alive and they attack you. I had that happen to me. Yay.
Yep, and the blood forest is also a fun one. It's like everything seems pretty normal. And then somebody casts a spell out of it or into it and the trees suck up the magic and start getting hungry. And so they attack everybody that's nearby. And then they might just wander off.
That's right, yes. That's very interesting stuff. All right, let's move on to some of the general core.
I was going to say, it makes the Warhammer world come a little bit more alive.
Mm-hmm.
A little more of the fantastical nature and not just the we're in the medieval fantasy world.
And there's also, on the idea of terrain, there's some thematic terrain. Like some of the factions, for example, the goblins have the mushroom forest, which helps them out a little bit. Isn't there also like a dwarven brewery that you can play down that causes like the dwarves to defend it fiercely and stuff like that, right?
Yep, and it's balanced. There's also, you know, evil temples.
Mm-hmm.
Temples, sacred walls. You know, and you don't know what they're going to be till they hit the temp, you know, till they hit the tabletop. So, it can help you or it can hurt you. And, you know, it doesn't really matter which side, it goes for. As long as you know how to work around it and use it, it can work to your advantage.
So let's talk a little bit about general core gameplay. These are not, like, just things that happen all throughout the entire game. Some of the big changes. One is pre-measuring. Now, in previous editions of 40K and Fantasy, at least some of the more recent ones, you couldn't sit there and measure, you know, how far is my guy away from my enemy unit. You basically had to kind of guesstimate a little bit, and that led to some, obviously, a risk-taking if you wanted to charge or try to shoot. You weren't always completely certain. Of course, now you can do measuring like that. You can measure basically the distance between any two units at any given time. What do you think about this in the case of the Warhammer Fantasy setting? Is it good, bad? Will it speed things up, slow things down? What do you think?
It'll definitely speed things up, unless you run into the bean counter personality who has to measure everything twice and enter it in on, you know, his PDA 14 times and check his spreadsheet to see his probability of success and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few of those out there always. But one of GW's other games, Lord of the Rings, introduced the pre-measuring.
Okay, there.
When we saw that there, it was like, oh wow, why don't we do this for fantasy? Because this is so much easier. And now it's part of the rules. So it's kind of been field tested with the Lord of the Rings. And I think it's a good thing. Some people say that it takes away from the player skill of being able to guess those ranges like that. But I think it takes the variable nature and puts it back to the dice instead of your ability to guess depending on the lighting and, you know, what you remembered setting it down next time, or the board happens to have a couple little cues on it or little things like that. The guessing like that always seemed to be kind of annoying.
And even in the past, there's always kind of shady ways you could kind of get a better idea how far you're away by measuring, you know, like a known distance and comparing it to where you're at. Or in Warhammer Fantasy, you had the, oh, I can't march if I'm within 8 inches of somebody. So you can measure out 8 inches to see if you were, you know, you thought you're about 8 inches from an enemy unit. You measure that distance. Oh, look, I guess I'm not 8 inches. And you can figure you're like 10 inches or something. So, whereas before there's shady ways of doing it, now it's nice and open. And I think just from experience with other games, as long as a game focuses on aggression, pre-measuring won't be a problem. I know in the case of MechWarrior, specifically the alternate version of MechWarrior Kyle and I created, which ended up being a lot of defensive line stuff, what would happen is with all the pre-measuring, you get to situations where no one would want to step into what's called no man's land and just die. So you basically end up building these weird gun lines that shift around. Obviously, Warhammer Fantasy being fantasy and not, you know, science fiction, you won't see so many gun line kind of armies. But they really have to focus on aggression. I think that'll get around the whole issue of pre-measuring, at least in my opinion. It'll mitigate any problems it would cause.
Right, which it's a nice segue into a couple different rules changes.
All right, go for it.
A couple different sections, so I'll just go ahead and get them. Warhammer, the whole Warhammer world has always been thematically a very bloody place.
Mm-hmm.
They have amped that up. They've ratcheted it up a couple notches. They've cranked the volume to 11, so to speak. The game itself, the history, the background, it's all been focused on the fact that this is a bloody war. It's not skirmishes off on the frontier. This is the, you know, entire civilizations throwing themselves against each other in a this could be the last stand every day kind of battle. Nobody's maneuvering around, plinking a couple arrows here and there. You're emptying your quivers, your sword's growing dull because you've been chopping at enemy skulls for so long. Everything has gotten more bloody, and it has actually taken place with a very few subtle rules changes. One of them is fighting in an extra rank. Before, it's only the guys that used to be in front. They're the ones that fight. Now, you get supporting attacks from the ranks behind you. Spears, but, you know,
everybody.
Even the guys with swords lean in between and, you know, stab and help out that way. And with spears, you know, the typical weapon that you fight in a couple ranks, you know, good old Roman style, those get you another one. Another rank of support, so you actually have three ranks of troops that are fighting, and some armies like the High Elves that have had bonuses because they're disciplined, you know, and trained, you know, centuries of warfare trained into their souls, they can get an additional rank into that. And then there's the Horde rule, which if you field a unit that's basically twice as wide as normal, 10 models instead of 5, that gets you an extra rank of support. So with spears and the Horde rule, you can easily end up with 30 or 40 models fighting, where before you might only get 5 or 6. That makes it much more bloody.
Yeah, I remember like when we're going through all the rumors of Warhammer Fantasy, one of the big ones that kept coming up was the battles are going to basically be a lot faster. When two units fight, it's going to go down a lot faster. And, you know, there's all sorts of crazy ideas being tossed out there. Are they going to do it like Flames of War? Are they going to do it like this game? Whatever it is. And the answer was, it's going to be faster because there's just more attacks.
Right. Yeah, they didn't try and duplicate anybody. They just tried to make what they already do bloodier by doing more of it. You have more attacks. Battles, they're not decided by a handful of wounds on either side. You know, it's not unusual to see a dozen models felled on each side in a given round. You know, it's like, you have two units that run into each other, and before, in the 6th and 7th edition, the winning unit might lose a couple models and then just move on, you know, hammer style to hit the next one. Well, now, even if you have a good, solid win, you might only come out at half strength.
Yeah, I think this fixes two issues with the game. One, even though I never saw it too much, I mean, there are people who talk about where, say, turn two different units or two units of guys that charge into each other, and they'd spend the rest of the five turns of the game just hacking away bit by bit at each other, because no one would do enough damage to where someone would fail a runaway check or someone would just be completely wiped out. Well, I guess, did you ever have that trouble where that would happen, where you'd have two units kind of collide and just sit there for the entire game grinding away at each other?
Oh, yeah. Happened all the time. Sometimes, you know, there were units that you specifically used as speed bumps to do that. I used to have a unit in 6th edition, Snotlings. They're just, you know, little things. They don't do much damage, but they used to be unbreakable, so you couldn't make them run away.
Okay.
So they'd just be a speed bump. You'd go shove them in front of somebody, and it would take them two or three turns to kill their way through them. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, this little disposable unit I have is holding up this elite unit of knights who, you know, they can kill, you know, a whole bunch of snotlings every single turn, but, you know, the one knight kills one snotling. It's like, well, that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, that same knight could be killing some elite trooper. Now you don't run into that as much. You're going to have a lot of casualties on both sides, no matter what. And eventually, even if nobody runs from the battle, eventually you're going to run out of guys. One side is just plain going to run out of guys. I've seen that in a couple of battles where we've simply killed off the opposition before anybody, you know, has a chance to break from combat. The combats have been even as far as, you know, the amount of damage and the whole combat resolution that was introduced in 6th edition. You know, everything's been even, but the attrition on both sides has been heavy to the point where you actually run out of guys. And then your victory unit's like, yay, I've only got 6 guys left. Now what do I do?
Now, all this being said, the speed bump tactic is still somewhat valid, correct? I mean, you can still send a weaker unit to delay a more powerful one, but it's not going to time over the whole game. It's probably going to be one, maybe two turns if you're lucky, right?
Right. Speed bumps, I mean, you know, that works in the real world. It's not a very nice tactic to send another, you know, group of people to be a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Out on the tabletop with our fantasy armies, it sees a little more use, hopefully, than it does out in the real world. But, yeah, it's still going to happen. But the reality is, because of the amount of damage that can be caused, if you don't send enough of the unit out there for a speed bump, it's just going to find itself slaughtered.
Because then the other thing I was thinking about that this kind of fixes is, what I didn't like, say, in 7th edition or 6th edition, you'd have two blocks of maybe 20 or 30 troops march towards each other. They'd be a round of combat. One side might lose 3 guys, and they would turn and run, and they get chased down. It was like they were running with, you know, with only suffering minimal casualties. This way, you've got so much stuff dying, it seems a little more practical that one side might run over the other. I mean, you might run away.
Yep, exactly. And one of the things they did to adjust that as well is units have a couple different rules, a couple different changes to help them stay in combat longer instead of running away. There's the steadfast rule. If you happen to have more ranks than your opponent, then you become stubborn. You test on your natural leadership instead of testing on modified leadership based on, you know, how many you lose. And the battle standard bearer, which lets you retake break tests, now it lets you retake any leadership test, so fear checks and other things like that, you're not going to see them running away from, you know, oh, I broke a nail, anywhere near as often. People are going to stay in combat, even though they're losing people at a far greater rate than they used to.
And while we're on the topic of running away, two things. First of all, another thing that would cause people to run away a lot in 7th edition was if you lost combat to a fear-causing unit that outnumbered you. You'd only stay if you rolled double ones, correct?
Right, right.
Yeah, and that's gone as well. So now some armies like vampire counts have been nerfed a little bit because, you know, they now basically function like a normal unit. The fear doesn't cause you to automatically run unless you stay in combat a little bit longer, ironically.
Right. One of the other changes that made things more bloody, that I didn't bring up before, was the fact that you always get a chance to fight back unless you're dead.
Yes.
6th and 7th edition, the Chargers went first, and if they managed to kill that entire front rank, nobody would fight back. Now you have the whole principle that everybody moves up. You know, the guy in front of you dies, you stand on his corpse and start swinging your sword. You know, you don't just stand there and say, oh, well, they killed Bob, and just watch. You know, you bastards, you killed Kenny, and you go after them, you know. And that's the way things would be more realistically, I think, although, you know, using the word realistic in a discussion about Warhammer Fantasy is somewhat silly.
How about more expected or more expected a response for somebody than to just stand there and not do anything?
Right. That makes sense. So you end up with a bloodier battle because people are stepping up, you're doing more attacks, and you know, if you're going to run away, well, that's going to be because you know, not only did you lose Bob, but you lost Fred, Kenny, you know, Jared, Reggie, you know, all the Kens, all the great, their uncles, brothers, sons, and grandpa too. You know, I mean, you're going to run away because something devastating happened. You're not going to run away because, you know, oh, I got a hangnail and Bob's boot fell off. You're not going to get that anymore. There's going to be a lot of dead models on both sides of the combat before anybody starts running away. Fear, it did kind of get nerfed. It has a more obvious effect. You know, if things are scary, then you don't fight as well. So, you know, you still fight, but not as well against the scary things. But every army's lost something in the rules changes, and every army has gained something in the rules changes. That's never gonna be altered. Anytime you make any kind of rule change, it's gonna get, you know, swung around that way, and some people are gonna say, oh, my army's no good anymore. Other people, you know, like me, are gonna like, oh, wow, cool, I get to do this now.
Yep. How about here, we're actually getting close to the end of the show, we're at almost 40 minutes. So let's finish up one more topic on close combat, then I got an email to read, and we'll probably continue the rest of the Warhammer Fantasy discussion on another episode when we've got a few more people on to talk about it. So, for the last topic here, one thing I want to mention is the loss of the fact that when you charge a unit, you no longer get the strike first. And this is the one thing that I can be like, this rule blows for me, because I'm Lizardmen, and we have generally very low initiatives. So, whereas before I could use my Saurus Warriors or my Saurus Cavalry to charge into somebody and get a first strike with lots of powerful attacks, I don't necessarily get that anymore. Especially if when I have small numbers, let's say the Cavalry, where I get my front line all crushed. But...
Oh yeah, I can definitely feel your pain there, playing my Orcs and Goblins with an average initiative of 2.
Hey, it's like us.
Yeah, you know, I run into that. I don't get to strike first.
Mm-hmm.
But it's balanced with that, you know, the rule I brought up. You do get strike back.
Yeah, that's true.
If I have 30 attacks coming and 40 guys, you've got to kill at least 11 if you want less than 30 attacks coming back at you. So I don't care that your initiative is, you know, 715 and you get to go first. I don't care if you're high elves with your, you know, hoity-doity, always strike first rule, I still get to fight back, and it's still going to hurt.
Yeah, I mean, I guess all it's really going to do for me is cause me to not use units of 5 Saurus Cold 1 Cavalry anymore. I'll probably, you know, have at a second rank, and I'd be all right. or even then, you know, third ranker. I don't know if I can do that. Those guys, I think so. But
yeah,
regardless,
absolutely. Small units of 5 cavalry
just not going to work anymore.
Not for heavy cavalry. The little fast cav, sure, you're going to see those with the wolf riders, the Illyrian reavers and stuff. But they're basically archers on horse. For the heavy hitting guys with the lances, you're definitely going to see more ranks, the way the Bretonians tend to do it. You know, a couple ranks up there to keep you going. The hammer isn't, this little ball hammer with weenie points hitting this huge anvil. Now you've got, this worthy Smith's sledgehammer that's hitting the anvil and squishing what's in between.
All right, so let's go ahead. I'm going to jump over to the email because, like I said, we're just about done with the show. So we're going to definitely have you on again, Brent, and probably a few other people. But this interesting email chain I've been involved with comes from, let's see if I can pronounce his name right, Alexandre Coissard. Hopefully I got your name right there. This man is a marketing director for a company called Bastion Studios, which, of course, you guys probably know as the makers of Ex Illis, who came across our not-so-positive review of the game. And we wanted to write a few things to us to kind of bring up some of the points we made in the game and some of the changes they made with Ex Illis. So a few of the things here, I've actually been going back and forth with him over the past couple of days a few times. Let's see here. One of the things he wanted to mention was, first off, was talking about Ex Illis was really designed for large-scale gameplay, which unfortunately we didn't really test because of the sheer expense of the game, which I mentioned in my response email. But he is wanted to let everyone know that in Gen Con, which I believe is next week, Ex Illis is going to be there running large-scale games anyone can play. So if you really want to try out a full-scale, large-size game of Ex Illis, that's available at Gen Con next week, as well as a tournament for Ex Illis if you want to play in that. Rules are on their website, which would be fun to try out. Did you ever, because I remember on the same topic of Ex Illis, I'm jumping from thing to thing. I remember I brought it over to your house and I played Jerry once. Did you watch us play that game, Brent?
Oh yeah, yep.
We're passing the iPad back and forth.
Yes, passing the iPad back and forth and giggling.
Yes. So, because I was explaining to him about, why we only bought the first starter set and kind of the whole situation and, how we do the reviews that we do. But long story short, I ended up passing a few ideas on to him about how he could possibly improve the game. And, of course, they mentioned they always release new versions of the software. So some of the issues with the bugs and things we had in our review have been fixed. That's another thing to look forward to. Also, the other thing Bastion Studios has already put out is a wiki on their site, which basically details a lot of the mechanics behind their software that run. So, when I was playing Jerry over at your house, we really had no idea what was going on in the background. It kind of led to some really goofy, crazy stuff, especially with that female wizard lady who has that razor wind attack that is driving Jerry up the wall. So now you can actually, if you want to, go read about all the strategies, all the tactics behind these guys, how they work, and it kind of takes away some of the magic, mystical, voodoo feeling of the software itself, which is definitely a good thing. I brought up your email, not the one I wanted to bring up. And anyway, long story short, some of the other ideas I sent back to him are specifically related to what I call the DRM on the game, where they very restrict how you can use your figures. Let me see if I can read off some of the ideas I had. So I gave him the ideas of, one, create called proxy credits. Because, one thing that drives me crazy about that game, in order to actually play the figures with the software, you have to have bought the figures, which goes against how War Machine works, how Warhammer Fantasy, 40K, every other game works. Not every other game, most games. And the nice thing about that, if they could actually implement, say, proxy credits, which allows you to test out units, that'd be a good improvement for them to make. Some other things was talking about how you can't create your own units. I gave some ideas about that. And also, I kind of mentioned some ideas how you can try to openly share figures, where you can basically take a figure set and give it to somebody else, and so they can use the figures. Well, you can't. So basically implement sharing in their software is one of the other ideas. And the last one I had a nice long paragraph about was how the fact that if I want to sell one of my units to you, Brent, I'd have to pay them a small fee, which I think is really ridiculous. They're basically trying to capitalize on the secondary market, and I came up with some ideas, particularly, say, limit the fact that maybe if I want to sell a figure to you, Brent, I can only, that particular unit, which has a barcode associated with it, can maybe only be sold once every 7 days. I think what they're trying to do is they don't want it to be where we're basically just trading units back and forth all day long, which, every other game can do that, but they don't want that to be the case here. I hope it's a decent job of summarizing up regardless. So anyway, those are some of the emails I've gone back and forth with the guy from Bastion Studios. I've already updated a text review, and I'll probably post maybe some of these comments I've said on my website, and we'll see what things go from there. So if he has more updates next time, I'll let you know. But we've been going for almost 45 minutes. Let's go ahead and let's end this show. And like I said, Brent, we will continue this discussion about Warhammer Fantasy next time or in another future episode not too far off. There's still a lot more to talk about. Magic phase, shooting, line of sight, standard scenarios, and all sorts of fun things. So thanks for coming on the show, Brent. Any last comments?
Play fantasy.
That's what I expect you to say. All right. Any questions or comments, or if you're a developer of a game we ragged on, you can always contact me over at jason@rockosoftware.com. That's rockosoftware.com. Of course, Twitter, TT_Battlefield. Steam for Rocker Robotics. If you want to, Steam name is Rocker Robotics. If you want to play, say, Left 4 Dead, Dawn of War 2, or the new Alien Swarm game. Have you seen that one yet, Brent? The Alien Swarm, the free game they released?
No, I haven't.
Really?
I've been buried in Dawn of War 2 lately.
Oh, okay. It's a free mod of the Source Engine where it's like a top-down kind of Left 4 Dead-ish thing where you're running around and shooting lots of aliens coming at you. It's basically like Space Hulk, except not in Terminator Battle Armor. But, you know, it's that kind of a video game. It's really a lot of fun because it's a four-player cooperative game. And, of course, when I'm done here tonight, I'll probably go into a midnight release party for StarCraft 2. So at some point, you'll be able to play me in StarCraft 2, which I don't know what my username would be for that yet, because I haven't got the game. I'll post that in the show notes if you want to contact me over Blizzard's Battle.net to play StarCraft 2. So that's all my long contact information. Once again, Brent, thanks for coming on. And I want to just go ahead and sign it off.
And this is Brent Bullmaster, the Warhammer Fantasy fanboy, saying goodbye.
All right, well, thanks, Brent, for doing that. Thanks, everyone else, for watching. We'll see you guys again in about 2 weeks on the next episode of the Tabletop Battlefield.